The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Martin Lee, and this is the Autosport Podcast. It's a perfect start for Red Bull with Max and Checo and a 1-2. All right, pedants, they didn't get the fastest lap, but it was otherwise a very good start to the season, but a nightmare for Ferrari. Oh, a Leclerc engine failure denying him what was probably going to be a podium today, and a dream start for Alonso, who capitalised on that Ferrari failure. Over Hamilton and Sainz on track. He did his work on track, but he scored third on the podium, his first outing for Aston Martin. That's how the season begins then. Let's have a good old discussion about it and work out what it means for this year and what we think of the start of F1 2023. Joined by our chief editor, Kevin Turner, by JBL, Jake Boxall, like formerly our technical editor, now F1 writer, because things changed this week, but we'll get into that. And Matt Q, who's going to be at a lot of the races, but is at home for this one, which is nice, our F1 editor. Chaps, welcome along to the first podcast of the year. Kev, I'll start with you. What's the best word? I think the best word has been used a fair bit this week, but I'll use it again. This is ominous for Red Bull, right? They looked to not even break a sweat. How did you read that one today?
Yeah, can we just skip over the potential for a championship fight and just talk about Fernando Alonso, who basically single-handedly saved the race? How honest should I be? I mean, there isn't going to be a championship fight, is there? Let's be entirely honest. You know, Red Bull were, you know, they were on, they, you know, Perez was second on the grid, which is, that's ominous. he did his usual thing of losing out to a faster driver in a slower car at the start. And then the basic race pace of the Red Bull pulled him up to second, by which time Max Verstappen had finished, had a coffee, shaking some hands, scored these 25 points. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you don't want to be too negative about it because it's just the first race. So it sounds ridiculous to say, but I'll be absolutely amazed if anyone can stop Max Verstappen taking his third world title this year. Is that too negative as a first?
No, absolutely not. Can because I, if the other, yeah, dive in.
Well, I was going to say, first of all, Kev, thank you for setting the tone, because I was just doing myself some dinner. I thought I'm going to have to start the podcast with a caveat saying, like, well, still buy Autosport, still come and read us, but it's game over already. But you haven't got as far as Russell, who said, Red Bull have won every single race. See you later. So maybe there is a middle ground in this that's not quite so,
I don't think they'll do that. So like, to win 23 races, like, there's going to be a mess up or a track where one of the other teams nails it. Yeah, I'll be amazed if they win all 23, but I wouldn't be entirely surprised if Max breaks the record that he set last year for wins in a season.
Well, that's why I say ominous, though, because Bahrain, obviously Formula One is a circuit-dependent sport. Depending on where you go, you do have better days and worse days, but Bahrain is one of those tracks that Red Bull just don't go well at. They haven't. I can't think the last time they won at Bahrain. I can't think of the last time they've certainly never had a 1-2 at Bahrain, and Verstappen's never won the opening race of a season. So that's lots of monkeys off of backs now. So here we go. But it's just like, Jake, I'll bring you in, because we were watching testing and they looked quick, but it was more the style of Verstappen saying, well, yeah, everything we sort of did work. So then we went a bit extreme to see if we could break it, and we did, and we dialed it back, and it was all okay. Like, when you were watching testing as our former technical editor, did you think it'd be this dominant though?
Well, I must confess, I didn't watch all of testing because I was away gallivanting in South Africa for Formula E. But the bits of testing that I did see, from the data that everybody had, from the general performances on the track, it just seemed like, you know, they'd managed to keep all of the best bits from their car last year, work on the things that didn't work so well. So obviously getting the weight down was a big thing, because that was part of the issues that they'd started last season with. They seemed to be incredibly reliable as well. I think it seemed ominous from the offset there. I think if anything, when it came to practice and qualifying, it was maybe a little bit surprising to kind of see the other teams so close in air quotes. you know, Alonso giving them a run for their money in practice, Ferrari looking quite quick in qualifying. But this race pace just seems to be something else. And that was something that they showed in testing. And that, you know, they've very much carried it over here.
So Max was from pole, off and away, never looked back. And that's what I'm trying to work out, because when you have these like periods of dominance in Formula One, of we are undoubtedly in a Red Bull period now for who knows how long, you never know how much the car is turned down, how much the driver is just reining in. I guess, Matt, like, you can't, because you study the lap times, you know, you and Alex Kalanorkis, who were sort of flip-flopping your job last year because you were writing the driver ratings, you were going through all of the lap times and stuff. So you can see that consistency and you can see how much pace they might have in the car. But it just seems to me that if any time they'd said to Max, can you go half a second quicker for the next 10 laps? He'd be, yeah, fine, that's no problem. Like, it just seems they could have just done anything, any tire strategy. It just would have worked today, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it seems that way, doesn't it? I mean, this is what the new rules, the exact opposite of what they were intended to do. We have this convergence, and now, you know, team principals are talking about, well, it might be the better part of a decade before the cost cap erodes the advantages. And then in the second year, the rules, regulations, and third year, the cost cap, one team's pulled even further away, which is a bit ominous. I mean, I think if we want to clutch on to the straws of optimism, I think, oh God, it comes from probably the Bahrain tarmac, because the drivers are saying it's like a cheese grater. It just destroys the rubber, which really hampered Ferrari significantly. And Aston and Red Bull seem to excel, but it's not massively comforting to rely on that to define the season. But the way Verstappen sort of bolted away, you know, 2 seconds clear after two laps, 6.5 seconds after 10 laps, over Leclerc, that's an awful long way to come back from. And you know, they did the soft hard strategy that didn't seem to interfere, you know, going light or low fuel on the hardest compounds. You know, the Leclerc having from his Q3 strategy, having the fresh set of softs at the tires, that never paid off. In fact, he pitted before Leclerc, and then Red Bull responded, so that fresh tire advantage counted for, it's late and I'm running out of sophisticated, polite vocabulary. It didn't count for a lot in the end. So that is all, I suppose, immensely troubling. And Verstappen seems, you know, quite happy. But to go back to sort of how you framed it is sort of, what's the car, what's the driver almost. I hate to be this simplistic, but when we were working out, going through the data last year to work out what was car and what was driver, you sort of look at the teammate and that was the difference there. I think the 11.9 second margin at the end was probably a bit flattering. I think Verstappen had another couple of gears, and I'd almost put it upon Red Bull that they said, Max, can you just complain about the downshifts rear locking so it doesn't look too easy for us, so they don't step in with a regulation change anytime soon.
They're like radio sandbagging in the first event of the year.
Well, there's a lot from what Max said I'd like to pick up on. The first is, yes, I think Max seems to have a Lewis Hamilton style thing of, if things look a bit easy, I must invent a problem. Like, almost in his, maybe it's the thing that they need to just keep batting against the odds, even when it's, you know, frankly, a cakewalk for them. So Max seems to have picked that up from Lewis. I think when you've got a great driver in a great car, and let's face it, run by a great team, like they just make victories look easy, don't they? Yeah, we saw it with Marcus Schumacher at Ferrari. I think he's great at individual drives, or when Ferrari was a bit rubbish. And when everything was working with Jeantot and Ross Brawn, Rory Byrne car, he didn't have to delve too deep into his own ability too often, because he'd got it won beforehand. And I think we saw that with Lewis Hamilton at Mercedes at times. And I think we're entering now a period where Max probably doesn't have to be absolutely wringing the neck heroic. You know, you look at the onboard of his pole lap, it all looked very easy. Didn't look like he was, you know, didn't look like the Max Verstappen of 2 or 3 years ago, who was really hanging it out. That's what Charles Leclerc looks like when he's when you see him pushing. But just to pick up on one thing that Matt said about the rules, I don't think we can blame the rules. I don't think you can do anything more on the regs to close up the field. Like, they've got you know, they've got the cost cap. Okay, so it will take a little while for these things to filter through, but you've got a cost cap. You've got this sliding scale of wind tunnel and, you know, all the resource restrictions. Like, basically, everyone else has to do a better job. Ferrari can kind of understand the logic of what they tried to do. They had a decent car last year they didn't make the most of, and they've just tried to iron out the problems with it. As you've seen today, perhaps they haven't been entirely successful there, but you can kind of see the logic. The one I don't really understand is Mercedes, because they had a concept that didn't work and continues to not work. whereas Aston Martin have just been pragmatic and go, let's do what Red Bull were doing. And they've made a massive leap up the field. So we will get to convergence eventually, but I think it'll take a while.
Hmm. That's the point, isn't it? That, you know, without being too flippant, the three cars on the podiums were Red Bulls today. You know, whether it's a Dan Fallows carryover of technology or just the inspiration. And, you know, I know that Aston got some stick when they turned up with that update in Barcelona and go, oh, it looks just like the Red Bull. But at this point, after a year and teams not binning off their car concepts and, you know, meeting the definition of insanity, which is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, it is up to them to change and up to them to mimic Red Bull now. Like, I don't think that's like a taboo subject or us trying to get a cheap laugh. That is what has to be done. And I know, you know, you can be quick to point out that I think the balance is pretty much 60-40% on 60% of the floor is doing the heavy lifting and the top surfaces make up 40%, maybe less in a ground effect area. But from what you can see, or from, you know, if Verstappen's car ever breaks down and needs to be craned, and if they can get a peak of the underfloor, that's what the other teams need to be doing to be competitive now. And actually, just in that sort of car driver debate, Kev, I know that you have now banned referring to Sergio Perez a tire whisperer in any way, partly because it's cliche, but it's because Verstappen, that is an underrated element of his driving, is he can nurse a Pirellis, which he did today, why he can have it in and reserve and why that was a consummate performance. And this is me for, you know, all the times Verstappen generally doesn't get the credit he deserves, because that we constantly, whether it's Mercedes and Lewis or whatever, it's always the car versus driver debate. But that is one area where he totally excels and is doing again this season.
Toto Wolff came out afterwards and said it was bad. In fact, I wrote the quote down so I can tell you exactly what it was verbatim. That was one of our worst days in racing. The Aston Martins are very fast and the Red Bull is just on a different planet. It hurts that they are so far ahead. So yeah, customer of theirs finishing on the podium in a race that's almost 60 laps, both their cars almost 60 seconds behind. So, you know, second a lap, near as damn it. So JBL, you are head of Mercedes, technical director. Do you throw in the towel now and go, right, what's Newey over the road done?
Well, the issue is what can they do? Everybody's so kind of hemmed in with cost cap and everything, you know, is how much do you want to spend on trying to get something out of the car they've got now, the W14. They've already got stuff kind of in the pipeline for that and to try and alleviate some of the issues that it has. But the bottom line is, whatever they do to it, even if they tack on some updates, it's going to be worth what, like maximum a little bit less than half a second. That's still not enough. That's still not enough per lap. It's not enough to fix their qualifying disadvantage. It's not enough to fix their race pace disadvantage. So the earliest you can really do it is next year. And so this seems like it's going to be another season of trying to squeeze every last drop out of a car concept that they know definitively, but it's one that they've said it's got promise and we just need to unlock it and we just need to do this and we need to do that. But sometimes when you can't unlock a bank vault with a house key and they'll spend forever trying to unlock something out of it. But if there's no, you know, if you can't get in, then you know, it's a pointless exercise in trying to waste resources and trying to do that. So again, it is the earliest thing they can do is probably next season, unless they want to throw caution to the wind and, you know, spend a load of money on trying to create a B-spec. But again, in the parameters of what you've got with regards to wind tunnel testing, with the team, the resources that teams have, it's so much harder to course correct now. And I think that's something that they're going to have to contend with. When it came to the cost cap penalty that Red Bull got last year, for example, it was easy for them to deal with because they already had the quickest car and the concept clearly worked. If it had been them in Mercedes shoes and then having to contend with a cost cap penalty, it would be, you know, they'd be midfield, low midfield at best. This is the problem they have to work through. Whether they can suddenly find something out of the car, it seems more and more unlikely by the day. And I think they will be either putting a lot of money into trying to create a halfway house for this season, then try and do something different for next year, or they'll be spending a lot of money on photographers to try and stand by every single conceivable corner just in case someone gets craned off and they can have a little look at the floor.
Oh, no, but come on, Adrian Newey will have put a self-destruct button in the Red Bulls. Like, if it's going to get lifted, they'll hit it and it'll just spontaneously come back.
It'd be like a little like hovercraft skirt that just popped out.
I mean, surely Mercedes will have a Red Bull-style side pod concept bolted to the car for Spain. That's surely it's going to be something like that, isn't it? As close as they can get with the current car, which is perhaps not as close as they'd like.
So where is Mercedes in the pecking order? Fourth?
I think so. I think the worrying sign is that where it is now? So, you know, last season, the whole big thing was they had this theoretical concept, which was class-leading levels of downforce. And then the porpoising sensation came and it took three quarters of a season to properly nail what made that tick. They've gone away over the winter, and they've set themselves some performance targets of what they need to do to close the gap. And now they've met them and they haven't got a fundamental problem like porpoising. So this is where they are now. And yes, there was the changes from Friday to Saturday where they, you know, were fiddling with the balance and basically said, we think if we do this, we'll get a 10th, and they gained half a second. That's great. But they're still, 6 tenths a lap down on the leading contenders. And they're not really sure why they got that half a second from. So while that is problem solving of another sort, it's not like a low hanging fruit, a silver bullet, any cliche like porpoising. It's a car that's not quite quick enough. And I think, as JBL says, that's where you throw caution to the wind. And, you know, we are hearing a new spec side pod where it, you know, they'll move away from this sort of like cuttlefish, like size zero thing they've got. Whether they go sort of for a more Red Bull design, I don't know. Or whether they immediately bin off this season, almost like Haston in 2021, go everything's for next season. You know, Toto Wolff has said we need a new concept. Russell's already at the point where he's going, well, I think we need a new concept just to tick a box, really, which that sort of more resigned attitude is quite telling. But Toto Wolff has said, right, Hamilton, you know, we've seen from Alonso what Hamilton can do, how long he's gone for. We're going to give him his 8th world title. Toiling around with this car isn't going to do that. They've not got a new wind tunnel to wait for like McLaren is. So they have to take really firm, decisive action. And in Mercedes' case, where they're so, you know, really sort of buy into this no-blame culture, they're not going to sack a technical director. They might bring James Allison back into the fray a bit more than he is now with his upstairs role. But, you know, they've got their lot and they need to sort of act with what they've got, and sticking with this car is not going to be the best way to maximise those resources. I know, to prattle on a little bit, but Toto Wolff has been big on, you know, last season he was reading up on the post-Sir Alex Ferguson era at Manchester United because he sees why sporting dynasties fall. And his attempts to rescue it has so far taken a team from third to fourth. So they need to sort of get off that path. They need their Erik ten Hag moment, although I'd say that after that I think they've just been whooped 7-0, so that's a terrible analogy.
Even I, who I don't know anything about, even I know it's a bad day to be talking about Manchester United.
I was covering Formula One, I do apologise.
It's the joint heaviest defeat in Manchester United's history, losing 7-0 to Liverpool. So, yeah, fallen dynasties, post-Ferguson. That's all good stuff. That's all very topical for our joint F1 and football fans. So, Mercedes are fourth. Who's second, then, in terms of the pace after today? Is it Ferrari or is it Aston Martin? Who's behind Red Bull?
Based on today, you have to say Aston Martin, I think. One, because if you look at one lap pace, I think you can make a case that Alonso obviously didn't run later in the session, so loses a bit of time there. But, you know, it's race pace. That's the decisive factor. And the way that Aston was second only to Red Bull in terms of tyre degradation and Lance Stroll, who is poor on mileage, being so competitive as well, I think that underlines it. It's not, you know, some of it is Alonso heroics, but that is fundamentally a mega car. Ferrari was struggling badly with its degradation. And I think if we've ruled out Mercedes as the second fastest to the answer to your question, Martin. So let's look at Ferrari, where Alonso could nail his hard tyres in that final stint to pass Hamilton with a brilliant manoeuvre, to pass Sainz with a really engaging battle, and then streak 4 seconds ahead of Sainz and never pay the consequences for having absolutely rinsed his hard tyres. And Ferrari are clinging on to the Bahrain asphalt being an outlier, being so abrasive. But the fact that there weren't consequences, there wasn't a trade-off, and you know, before we talk about Ferrari unreliability or any of that business, the Aston did it on merit. And you know, if you wind back to last season and people going, well, they'll be slightly better off anyway because Alonso will give you that two tenths that Vettel never could. I think Alonso was mega where he picked his passes, but that was a brilliant car working very, very effectively. So when it comes to Jeddah, because I think the Aston was so good because of the way they were so late on the brakes and their mechanical low speed grip, but they do have a top speed deficit. Whether that is tunable with setup or whether they are behind in Jeddah and there is a toing and froing remains to be seen. But on the basis of a Grand Prix today, Aston Martin are the second fastest team, in my opinion.
All right, does Kev agree?
Yes, in terms of, I think today, like I agree with what Matt said, but I think the two caveats I would say are Sainz was off it this weekend. Like, he doesn't like Bahrain. He was well off Leclerc. Let's remember, Leclerc was well down the road when he would have been third. Yeah, it's great to see Alonso on the podium. I'm sure we'll get onto that in a minute anyway. But he would have been fourth. So, and I think that there will be other tracks where the Ferrari will be stronger because of the tyre degradation won't be such an issue. So I still think if I was to say, oh, who do you think is going to finish second in the Constructors' Championship? I still think I'd go with Ferrari at this point. But it is tantalising to think that Alonso has got a car that's now... Yeah, that fight with Lewis is the one we've been waiting for 10 years, isn't it? Finally, like Alonso's finally got a car. Yeah, on the commentary, they said, oh, we've been waiting for this for the last 15 laps. I went, I've been waiting for it for 10 years. Yeah, we've wanted Alonso and Hamilton to go wheel to wheel in roughly equal kit. Okay, so the Aston was quicker today. And it was mega. Like, they were, that was two proper drivers. Actually, Alonso had a great race with Russell. Then he had a great dice with Lewis. And then a good one with Sainz as well. So, it was fantastic. So I do agree with Matt. I don't think it was just Alonso heroics. The fact that Stroll could beat George Russell, having not driven the car, basically. I mean, I think that shows you how good the Aston is. So today, I would probably put it second. Overall, it's still probably plump for Ferrari. But isn't it a shame that Alonso let himself get done by Lewis on the first lap and then got tapped by Stroll? Because how could he have given Leclerc and, well, not Verstappen, but maybe Perez a bit more to think about? Would have been interesting. Could have
done. Exactly. That's what I want to tack on. You've come up with my rebuttal, Kev, which is great, but sort of dials down the debate we're trying to have on a podcast. I think bigger picture.
Sorry, you can just cut the last 10 seconds out and you can cut in. So Martin can make the magic happen.
I've just come up with an inspired point, which I'll now add all off my own back.
Slick, really slick. I like it.
Thank you. I think, bigger picture, you're still looking at Ferrari second. And I know it's, what ifs and all of that stuff. But if everything is all fair and equal, and even if you separate qualifying and Alonso perhaps underselling himself with that lap for fifth place, if Leclerc doesn't get ahead of Perez and Alonso doesn't get squeezed out by Hamilton, maybe there is a bit more of a question mark of who would have got that podium position. Maybe it wasn't quite as cut and dry where Leclerc would have nailed it before his engine went bang. Obviously, we don't know that. And you know, part of the pressures of multimedia and whatever is that we're doing a podcast on the night of. I haven't had a cup of tea and really sort of vacillated all over the data and the lap times to see if there's a like-for-like comparison on Alonso's race pace on a certain stint with Leclerc. But maybe it wasn't quite so cut and dry that he gets the final spot on the podium if he doesn't retire.
Absolutely. All right, let's... JBL, agree? It goes... So what's your order? Who's second and third on pace?
Tempted to just kind of not get in too much in the way of the debate and go straight down the middle and assume my usual role as fence sitter.
Splinters out of your backside, please.
I think when it comes... It's going to be a case of... On this basis, at least, and it's going to be track by track, I think. And Matt's already mentioned the pace that Aston has got in those very, very low speed corners. you take that to somewhere like Monaco, for example, imagine what what we could be in for. Ooh. If Alonso can get a good qualifying lap on the go. You know, that could be something. But I think, you know, there is a clear advantage that Ferrari's got in the slightly quicker sections of the circuit. And, you know, Leclerc was very, very quick in qualifying as well. And that's something that Ferrari does kind of take as kind of a good omen. Frederic Vasseur was, you know, he wasn't willing to kind of, let's say, get too bogged down in the negatives, even though it was a very, very difficult day. The fact remains that, you know, Leclerc was still, what, 0.3 off of Verstappen in qualifying. And, you know, that's something that, you know, race by race, venue by venue, that can change, and Ferrari can still be in the hunt. I don't think it's going to be the doom and gloom that Russell was predicting, where Red Bull would theoretically win all 23 races. I think Ferrari's still got something there, and I think they've got something about them, and I think it's just a case of getting on top of whatever reliability issues have kind of reared their head. Again, that does kind of skew things a little bit today. I think at the moment, Ferrari is probably still on balance the second quickest. But again, as I say, race by race, that can change. And there will be days where Aston Martin just has that edge. And, you know, particularly Alonso, because he's showing absolutely no, very big cliche, but he's showing no signs of slowing down at his tender age of, what, 42 now?
42 this year, yeah.
42 this year.
If not already.
No, he's still 41. I know this because it's nice to have someone on the grid who's still just fractionally older than I am. It makes me happy. I mean, while we're on the positive, nice to get a positive from JBR there. Also, we're talking about we've been waiting for someone to join the big three for years, haven't we? Really, I know we've had the odd win here and there from obviously Ricciardo got the win at Monza and Ocon got his Alpine win. But I mean, that they were kind of crazy 1970s, 80s star races. In terms of genuine pace, it's been a big three for a long time. And Aston Martin genuinely looks like they're going to be in the mix with at least two of the big three. And I think that's fantastic. It's great from a general F1 point of view. And yeah, I'm going to be biased and say I really want to see Alonso up there. And if he can win, I don't mind if Red Bull win 22 races, if Alonso wins the other one and gets his first win for 10 years, that'd be absolutely awesome.
So I spent the last probably quarter with Alonso just riding on board. So I'm using Multiviewer, which I've seen loads of people on social media talk about. And I thought, right, that's it. I'm going to get into it. Listening to all the radio, watching it from his onboard. And so I watched that through him getting Hamilton and then dropping Hamilton at the restart after the virtual safety car. He just timed that. I think they had the camera facing backwards at the time, and he just absolutely timed it perfectly and dropped him. And then when he got Sainz, I'm pretty sure they did make contact, and then he was just off. And the engineer said to him after maybe a few more turns, be careful, he's still 0.8 seconds behind. And just, it's like he was going for a walk in the park. Alonso just so calmly said, yeah, don't worry, he's going to kill his tires. That was his response. That was when Norris was staying with that little chasing pack as well. That's when he said, this car is lovely to drive. I think that made the world feed. And I agree, Kev. I just want, like, an Alonso, a happy Alonso provides a lot for Formula One. And also, a very unhappy Alonso provides a lot.
I was going to say, I think he provides a lot to F1, whether he's happy or furious. He's just a great person to have on the grid. But today, we really saw the on-track thing that he brings. You know, that race would have been, if it hadn't been for Alonso and Aston Martin, we'd have had two Red Bulls running away from two Ferraris, one of which then broke, and then running away from two Mercs. And it would have been like, oh, God. But Alonso, basically, with his overtakes, and so he's slightly out of position from where he should have been, really.
Yeah.
But he just, yeah, the pass on Lewis was fantastic. Hamilton, I think, was brilliant in the wheels. It was all good wheel-to-wheel stuff. There was no idiotic driving today. It was all quality drivers doing proper motor racing.
It was good.
That was great.
Unlike IndyCar today at St. Petersburg, which has been a destruction derby, there was not too much carbon fibre left on the track today from Formula One. But you know, you're right, absolutely. It was great because he had that big swapper on turn four or something, or turn 10, and he caught it. And it was just such good action. It was funny afterwards. Rosberg interviewed Alonso on that sort of LED podium, which they now have. And you could tell when Rosberg said, did you like passing Lewis Hamilton and getting past him? Like, oh, Rosberg loved asking that question. I thought that was really nice. If Alonso can qualify up there at week in, week out, and we can see the race pace of that Aston Martin, and they can develop it through the year, which, as you've mentioned, Matt, Dan Fallows, for anyone kind of new or doesn't know, he was the former head of aerodynamics at Red Bull. Now he's technical director at Aston Martin. Then he learned from the best. And that's going to be brilliant to watch this year. Let's talk a little bit. So we've talked about Mercedes. Anybody want to chip in a bit more with Mercedes? Toto Wolff has said they're going to change concept. Lewis was down. Russell was down afterwards. Anything else you've heard?
I thought it was interesting to note that the early part of stints, Russell looked quicker, even to the point where he got on the radio and went, is Lewis just struggling or is he looking after the tyres?
Yeah.
And then, oh, he's struggling. But actually, Hamilton was quicker by the end of the stints. Like, he was still just that little bit better on time management and ended up quite a bit further down the road than Russell, which I think is good, actually. It's good. It shows that Hamilton's still at that very high level, and it gives something George to aim for and get even, you know, even better at. So I still think it's a fantastic driver lineup. But I thought that was quite interesting that early on Hamilton looked like he was kind of in the way, but actually he just managed the race brilliantly. I thought that he did say, didn't he, before the final stop, that he could have done more laps on those tyres, and they brought him in to try and stop the Alonso undercut. With hindsight, you could say, actually, maybe they should have just given up the fight on Alonso, let Lewis go longer, and then he'd have had more tyres to go at Science with at the end. So he'd have definitely lost to Alonso, but might he have been able to beat? So because he cruised up to the back of him and then ran out of rubber. They both did, didn't they? Science ran out of tyres first, and then Hamilton did, you know, in the dirty air, while Alonso just disappeared down the road. I mean, I did speak to Alex Kalanorkas after Flagfall, and he did say that one of Mercedes, who is out there, and one of Mercedes' problems is that they went kind of light on the aero to get some straight line speed and try and get a lap time out of the car. But then that hurts you because you slide around more and you screw the tyres. So I think they were in a compromised setup. And I think Hamilton was probably doing a very good job managing the tyres that only really became obvious more towards the end.
But I did find that particularly amusing when Russell sort of just starting to get on Hamilton about struggling and, you know, just asking a question of whether he can have the position and fires off at turn 10, which I'm guessing they're slightly staggered, but those two moments that was quite amusing. I also actually, on the subject of radio messages, I know you said you were listening into Fernando, but you know, he's given himself a reputation now. How much of that is gameplay when he says it's a lovely car? Because, you know, for every GP2 engine there is, and for every, it's the worst defending I've ever seen from my teammate, who said about Ocon. He knows there's an audience. He knows people are listening. So whether, you know, that's just sort of playing the game, really. I wonder about that Stroll, about that too, with the lap one collision with Stroll, the cynic in him, who says he knew damn well it was a green car in his mirrors, but just chose to keep it quiet and not reacting to that all the way through, just in the same way as when it was announced it was an Aston Martin signing and then Lance Stroll sort of fired him off the road in America. That was the one incident of last season he didn't seem to have a major grudge at. So sort of trying to, and then getting out of the car today and throwing a load of praise on Stroll, who actually is entirely deserving of that. I know there's that sort of slight debate over, is it irresponsible for him to come back slightly injured and deny a chance to Drugovich / you know, but better back then, we would have praised that kind of behavior with Lauder coming back from injuries, you know, to race in 76, that dilemma. But I thought Stroll gave a really good account of himself. But you know, the again, second guessing Alonso's actions, which is always amusing, whether Alonso getting out of the car and saying Stroll was mega, that's just to placate the team for as long as possible until the inevitable flare up next time when Lawrence Stroll deigns to suggest that his son should get the tweaked front wing.
Yeah, that was another part of the team radio picked up afterwards as well, when he said, Lance is my hero. What a result. And again, maybe that was for the world feed. I'm not sure that was played. That's when the engineer was sort of telling him, oh, by the way, you're on the podium, so you need to go to this place near the weighbridge and don't go to the usual place. First time podium since, what would that be, 2021, I guess, for Alonso. Right, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we will go through the rest of the field and work out who had a good day, bad day, and what it means for the rest of the season. Stay there. Right, welcome back to the Autosport podcast. Let's talk a little bit about the rest of the field then. In fact, I'm aware that I didn't do a rundown of the top 10 because I like to get into it straight away at the beginning of the show. Max Verstappen, Sergio Perez and Alonso with a podium. Carlos Sainz in the only remaining Ferrari, followed by Lewis Hamilton and then Lance Stroll with broken bones in sixth place. George Russell in seventh. Valtteri Bottas scoring points in Bahrain, because of course, because he always does. In ninth, Pierre Gasly and Alex Albon in the Williams in 10th. Yuki Tsunoda in 11th, because it's Bahrain, so of course he'll finish in 11th. Logan Sargeant is outing in 12th. Brilliant. K-Mag in 13th. Nick de Vries, 14th. And Nico Hülkenberg in 15th. Zhou Guanyu, fastest lap in 16th. And Lando Norris was classified two laps down in 17th. JBL, let me ask you a little bit about what you think of the Alfa Romeo, because in Bottas's hands, finishing 8th today, looked pretty good. Not quite as quick in Zhou Guanyu's seat. Although fastest lap at the end, that was a bit weird because he almost caught Alonso as Alonso was weaving across the line to celebrate. And it made a bit of a gap to go for the fastest lap, but okay, fine. What do you make of what Alfa Romeo have brought to this year?
The team is still very much in the kind of same size, same continuation as kind of last season. Obviously, with their P6 and the Constructors' Championship, they had a little bit more money and a little bit more resource to kind of go out and recruit and stuff like that. But they're still, at the end of the day, the kind of quintessential, let's say, slap bang in the middle team. Qualifying probably wasn't, you know, quite to their taste. But a lot of, you know, Bottas's performance in the race was him just taking a strategy and executing it really well. And it really worked out for him. I think the sort of key moment of that was when he came in for his first pit stop on lap 11. He'd come in for the hard tyre. And what he'd managed to do is actually overcut Fernando Alonso. And I think it was George Russell. Yeah, George Russell as well. So he'd managed to undercut them, was ahead of them, and obviously didn't have the pace to kind of keep up with them. But I thought that was very, very good, you know, kind of taking the strategy and taking the prerogative and doing the right thing there. And that eventually led to him being in that kind of position in the lower midfield. It was kind of almost a lonely race. He did have Pierre Gasly catching back up to him towards the end of the race, but I think Bottas kind of had it all in hand, and he was, you know, very sort of sensible and solid P8. So it was a really good afternoon from him. And just on Joe, he was kind of one of the drivers. It was him and Nick de Vries. They were kind of hamstrung a little bit towards the end because neither of those two pitted under the virtual safety car, and the cars around them kind of did. So you had guys like Alex Albon and Gasly and Tsunoda and Sargeant all kind of catching back up and making ground over here. And so what Alpha decided to do at the end was, you know, a brand, well, I don't know if it was a brand new set, but a set of soft tyres. And so he could go and do the fastest lap and take the point away from Pierre Gasly. So in, you know, a mirror to last season where Alfa Romeo was trying to ruin Aston Martin's race so they could beat them in the Constructors' Championship, they're there again, just, you know, trying to not quite play the fool as such, but try and be a nuisance. And it paid off again. Gasly didn't get that fastest lap point. And, you know, by the end of the season, it could be the case where they're split by a single point and that would have been the clincher. So, you know, even though it's the first race of the season, they're already thinking about that, which, you know, is quite an interesting note. You know, Joe had a sort of relatively decent race, wasn't really, let's say, in the hunt for points, but I think because qualifying was so compromised, you know, it was probably the best thing they could do.
Absolutely. And it wasn't very much 2x2 for the rest of the rest of the field as we work our way through, because after the top two Red Bulls and then the two Mercs, only one Ferrari finishing, and the two Aston Martins, it then was Alfa Romeo because Bottas was in seventh, and then Alpine, then Williams, and then AlphaTauri. And so kind of mixing it up, that midfield battle, Matt, that we're all looking forward to this year. Pierre Gasly was in ninth in the Alpine, and so that's worthy of a mention. in terms of Gasly getting 2 points. In the other Alpine, Esteban Ocon not classified, a DNF, because everything he did turned to crap today in terms of...
Can we introduce a new award? I think we should have the Comedy Performance of the Weekend Award.
I mean, it just got worse and worse.
It was three different penalties, and each one related to the penalty before. It's actually brilliant.
It was like stacking. It's like stacking blocks that my toddler does, and it's like it just more and more. So he finished. So the first one was he wasn't in his grid slot, and I thought it meant he went long, but he didn't. It was.
Enormous microphone shot. We can't hear that one. The listeners have got to see. That's brilliant.
Yeah, the host of the podcast dropping his microphone. So the first one was he was far too off to the side. Like, you look at that shot of the lights going out, and there's one car blatantly out of line. So there was that, and then it just kept stacking, and then it was the engineers touching the car 0.4 seconds too early, didn't serve his 5 second, and then you can tell the stewards sitting around going, well, what do we do now? So that was a 5 second, now it's a 10 second, speeding in the pit lane, have some more, sir. It was comedy,
and he should have completed the set and done a track limits violation like Hulkenberg. That would have been absolutely brilliant, wouldn't it? You basically have had a month added on to your race time at this stage. But can I just make
see you in Azerbaijan, Esteban?
Yeah. But can I just make a request to F1 and Sky? Like, it's not a 10 second time penalty, is it? It's just a 10 second penalty. You don't need to say the word time. It's not a 10 second length penalty, is it? Pointless extra word. It infuriates me every time. I'm sorry. I know that's just me being weird.
I can tell the writers in the room offended by that.
I say, if I can go incredibly niche, that was a worst jump start since John Alesi in Bahrain in a speed car. There you go. That's something to YouTube. It's quite amusing. Wow, I don't know if I've seen that.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, I'm stuck in the race now. Yeah.
But Matt, I think where I started this very rambling question was, how did you, what do you make of Alpine on their first outing, and how they might look for the next few races?
It's tough, I think, to call it anything other than a disappointment, since there was so much hype, both in terms of, you know, the steps forward taken by the car, you know, everyone's favourite evolution. Alpine, arguably, apart from Aston Martin, have got closest to revolution, the way they've completely reconfigured the rear suspension and cooling package. And the fact that they said, we are going to be in for a really lonely season because we're going to close the top three and move away from the rest of the mid-pack. So, you know, those, what's that, seventh and eighth place every week, they're ours. We're not going to be overtaking. So, you know, they fell some way short of that. Obviously, in terms of pace, it's a slightly more of a grey area. Esteban Ocon's race was so poorly executed, you have to set it to one side. But the way Gasly came back through was obviously deeply impressive. So it suggests there's hints and, you know, they're obviously not in the turmoil that McLaren are in or whatever. And you know, that you have to think there's more to unlock, and they are convinced they're going to outdevelop everyone. So, you know, that fourth, fifth place is still very much achievable. But once we got to testing, it was clear that Aston Martin were going to be the surprise package. But I thought Alpine would be the performer. I thought, you know, Alpine would be the one taking it to Merck, and Aston Martin would be sort of hanging on to their coattails. So by that measure, by their standards I've set for themselves, they disappointed, I suppose. Yeah, bit of a frustrating one for that, for them, just how badly the race was executed, whether it was Gasly on his side, you know, tearing off the whole weekend by starting from the back of the grid, or Ocon just ticking all the boxes, maybe doing that thing of, if I get all my bad luck and misdemeanors out of the way now, I'll be plain sailing, and then I can concentrate on falling out with a third or fourth teammate instead.
Scoring points today, Williams are off the mark already after the first event. Alexander Albon in 10th for Williams, and an outing for Logan Sargeant in 12th. So, finishing a lap down, but he's got to be happy. And actually, Kev, what do you think that Williams looks like? Not the fastest car out there, but drivable more than the last couple of years. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's got to be the sort of pleasant surprise of the weekend, hasn't it? Both the general where they slotted in, for Albon to get a points grade. Also, Logan Sargeant, I mean, he didn't set the world on fire in F2. He looked like he'd be a decent driver that, you know, deserved an F1 chance, but probably wouldn't be that amazing. But actually, you know, solid job, not a million miles behind Albon. Or was it 10th and 12th? Car looked balanced. Okay, so they're lacking a bit of overall downforce, which is can be said of pretty much any Williams since about 1997. since Adrian Newey left, and yeah, he's subsequently produced some quite useful cars. But yeah, I think they'd be probably pretty pleased with that. I think it's a lot better than we were thinking after testing. I mean, obviously Matt was at testing. I mean, my impression was that Williams, there was a feeling that they'd be, you know, kind of propping up the back again.
Albon said, hang on a minute, we need some praise here. We're the second best developers one winter to another after Aston Martin. And, you know, he sort of said we could have done even more because he felt he really left a bit of time on the table in qualifying. I think, Kev, though, if you go back and read my copy from the magazine from testing, we weren't saying they're going to be, well, actually, I did say that, I think, in the preview, that it'd be Cutter, Drifters, Blackmarkers, but trackside observations were that they had built a Formula One car. It looked really unremarkable, but all the better for that. Wasn't masses of understeer. And okay, they were having to back off a bit through the high speed because of, you know, as you say, the Williams lack of downforce, but it wasn't like the bouncing of the Ferrari, the terminal understeer of the McLaren and things like that. So I think a neat job. And, you know, James Vowles coming as team principal, he said he's obviously taking a job with assurances they'll be up to the cost cap. So if he can get a pretty handy operator and is a technical director too, without putting too fine a point on it, it will be to save the season because, you know, you need, or their chief designer has stepped into that role. You need someone to oversee that, both in terms of logistics and planning. So what resources you dedicate to 2023 car, what you pile into this massive reset they're going to have for next year. So if they get that right, then it's a competitive season. I expect them to sort of get shuffled further towards the rear, but as a debut, you know, as a debut for the FW45 goes, it's mega. You would expect that perhaps a bit more from Jeddah, where it is low downforce and they can just be sort of slippery in a straight line, and Albon's racecraft can overcome the, you know, bizarre nature of the track where you're peering through walls half the time to sort of, you know, pick your spots. But it was just so like, oh, it's a horrible word, but it's just so nice. It was such a nicely executed race from him. And yeah, Sargeant of the debutants probably gave the best account of himself, albeit he wasn't hampered by a bad car or bad strategy like the other two were.
JBL, you've come from a little while covering Formula E. And that's a series used to people coming in and buying teams and renaming them and shuffling around ownership and stuff like that. Let's talk about AlphaTauri. The story, of course, before the race and after around testing as well, was maybe AlphaTauri, if it doesn't perform as Red Bull owners and shareholders would like, then it perhaps could be sold. There's plenty that would come in. Andretti would like to enter Formula One, but that's different to buying a team versus getting a place on the entry list. How do you think AlphaTauri look today? JBL, what do you think about their prospects? And does that start to play into the wider team future as well, of what could happen to that team?
Well, I think it was a bit of a difficult day. Tsunoda was challenging Albon by the end of it, you know, arguably with a better car, because, you know, the Williams is, you know, good in the straight line, and they trimmed off some of the downforce, well, even more of the downforce, just to try and maximize that advantage, because, as we know, Bahrain's got very, very long straights, and, you know, you can make a decent amount, a chunk of lap time there. But, you know, Alex Albon elbows out, as is his wont, and as he's become very accustomed to doing of late, you know, just proved too strong. And I think, as I said earlier, De Vries was the other driver that was hamstrung by the chance of not having the opportunity to pit under the virtual safety car. And so he kind of dropped like a rock. And, you know, it was after such a strong debut last year covering for Albon at Williams, it was a much more difficult proper debut. But I'm pretty sure that having him on board, again, as you mentioned, I've done Formula E for the last year and a bit, so I've sort of gotten to know him quite well. He's quite a hard taskmaster and kind of the same kind of George Russell kind of mold. And as everybody kind of pointed to during testing, he had this big, long sort of checklist of things that the team can work on. And I think they'll be all the better for having him in the team. As I said, it was a difficult race and he was kind of outshone by Tsunoda. But, you know, again, it's, you know, it's his first proper Formula One race. He's used to cars with about, you know, probably less than half the power. So it will probably take him a little bit of time to get properly up to speed. You know, doing a one race in a Williams on a track that a Williams is supposed to be quite good at, that's probably, you know, it's a bit of a, you know, it's an outlier for sure. Mm. I think the team, with regards to takeover rumors, there was a sort of hands-off warning issued. There was sort of discussions that the new, I guess, chairperson of Red Bull, Oliver Minslav, was perhaps looking at cutting it off, because Red Bull, the Formula One team in itself, is self-sufficient now. It's got big sponsors. It's got Oracle. It's got, you know, massive sponsors putting in a lot of money. They're winning championships, which brings plenty of income as well. And AlphaTauri's not really doing that, and they're not really this self-sufficient team. Therefore, they're costing, you know, the Red Bull hierarchy a lot more money. And so that was kind of the general, I think, outlook of what it was. Again, as I said, there's been a hands-off warning issued. The team's apparently not for sale, but, you know, the team's been up for sale multiple times in its history. And I think, theoretically, I think if the right offer came along, it would be something for them to think about. I'm not saying that they would necessarily take it, but let's say Hi-Tech with its new backers came in and made an offer, or let's say Andretti made an offer with its hedge fund management company behind it and Cadillac behind it and all this, that, and the other. If they came in with an offer, if, you know, someone else came in with an offer, I'm sure it's something that they would look at. But because Formula One teams are so valuable now, it'd have to be the right price, and the right price would be, in this climate, astronomical, because they know that if the dilution fee goes up to $600 million for, you know, to cover off all of the teams, then they could go, oh, you could have a fully going team for $599 million. So yeah, I think the ball's in their court, and they're the ones with the F1 team. The race today wasn't particularly stellar, and, you know, it seems like they're kind of on the same trajectory as last season. Obviously, it would be nice to see them sort of improve a little bit and have a little bit more about them in the midfield. But for today, I think P11 for Tsunoda, solid. I think that's probably the best you can say about it.
Solid is the best. Kev, I didn't make too many notes on Haas. I can see that I wrote down that K-Mag started on hards, only driver at the beginning, and fell straight to the back. And that's about the, oh, and Nico Hülkenberg couldn't stay within the white lines and got told off for it. So that's about the only thing I've written down for Haas.
Well, Hülkenberg, he had the opposite to Bottas, didn't he? One of the reasons, apart from the strategy that JBR mentioned earlier on, the reason that Bottas got those points was because he made four places on the first lap as well and got himself in the mix. And Hülkenberg did the opposite. So let's be generous and say it's a bit of race rustiness, because he, you know, hasn't been in F1 for a couple of years. But I don't think the Haas had the race pace to really do anything from there. So he kind of qualified out of position, almost like a Jarno Trulli thing. Instead of having a Trulli train, he just fell straight back to roughly where he should be. And Magnussen didn't really get anywhere. And then obviously Hülkenberg, yeah, took the track limits thing. The one bit of the penalties that Ocon didn't manage to get, Hülkenberg got instead.
It would have been nice to get a full house, wouldn't it, for Ocon? It would have been like, tick all the boxes.
It's a little bit of a shame for Haas, because Bahrain is obviously a track that they quite often go well at. Obviously, they had that great result with Magnussen last year. So, yeah, you do wonder where they slot in. I don't think they were terrible, but I think that, you know, if people like, you know, Williams are doing a better job, then it's going to be that much more. Yeah, everyone's trying to improve, and I think there's been a lot of improvement, with the exception of the cars in orange.
I'm just going to rebuff your point a little bit, Kev, about Haas doing well in Bahrain. I think, okay, Hülkenberg had the damage, but I think this is where Haas life in F1 is for Haas at the minute. They
wow.
Well, that's what I mean. They've historically done well there, and they haven't today.
Well, last year, the reason they did well there is because, one, they wrote off a year piling resources into another car, and B, you know, because their freight was delayed, they were the ones testing in conditions identical to the race with their, like, sort of extra time homework in the evenings, and not, you know, that's having that extra data in conditions similar to the race has got to help from last year, which is why they got that sixth. But you know, they've got two safe pairs of hands of drivers. Neither are, I think, world class. But they've been brought in to save the two car-snapping seven-figure crashes that Mick Schumacher had last year, which means they can keep pace with development and not have to shelve the major upgrades. But they are a diminutive team, and even though the midfield is ultra competitive, and there may be a bit of to and fro from one track to the next, I think, you know, if Williams are an improvement, then it'll be up to AlphaTauri probably to keep Haas off the bottom of the table. I just don't think they're well enough equipped, really.
Okay, now let's talk. Now let's do it. Now let's talk McLaren, a team that continually surprises me in terms of how much I am disappointed by that team, and I shouldn't be anymore. But I continue to think they're gonna solve this. They hired Piastri. He's gonna be amazing. No, they haven't. Because they need to pit Lando Norris six times to fill it up with, what was it, hydraulics. Kev, I'll come to you first. The cars in orange, you said you're sure that they will get better this year.
Sure, it can't get too much worse.
Well, really, it can't get any worse.
It's a low bar. But a couple of reasons I say that. One is we already know, obviously, they've got upgrades planned. They kind of made that pretty plain in testing when everyone went, oh, this is bad. Well, no, don't worry, we've got some bits. So there was that. Also, remember how abjectly terrible they were in Bahrain last year as well. And actually, they turned things around pretty well last year and got themselves into that. Yeah, you could say they were sort of, you know, just Daniel Ricciardo away from being fourth in the Constructors' Championship. That whole debate about Alpine reliability versus Lando Norris scoring all of McLaren's points. So they did make recovery. So I'm sure they aren't going to be as bad as they looked today, but they did look absolutely terrible, unreliable and slow. So, yeah, you do wonder. I mean, we asked the question earlier in the year, you know, how long will Lando Norris really have patience? But I suspect he'd still be quite high on most people's shopping lists. And, yeah, he's going to be maybe taking those calls a bit more readily all the time. McLaren aren't showing any progress.
But then when Andrea Seidel wants him to drive for Audi in, 2026, that's another 3 years wasted at McLaren.
Will he wait that long? I'm not convinced he'll wait that long, but we'll see. Matt and Jake are going to be in the paddock. You can ask him.
That's
you can
a good
ask
point.
Him each race, take it in turns to ask him. So, a new contract.
Fair point, isn't it? The Ricciardo saga and Matteo Binotto being asked to hand in his notice shows that loyalty is, you know, it's not a thing in Formula One. I wonder if it makes the McLaren case better or worse that they're actually pretty pleased with how today went. Obviously, you know, the reliability was shocking. And I think that the reliability was shocking. And I think that is a serious concern now, because just all the niggling little bits where it was the fouling wheel arch eyebrows, whatever the hell they're called, you know, those partial sort of covers, they were fouling the bodywork. And now you've had the pneumatic engine pressure leak, which occurred at turn one and was sapping power and hurting the gearbox. And obviously they had to connect the airline. And then what was it? It was an electrical problem at the wiring harness at the base of the steering column was where that went wrong, which is why the new steering wheel didn't work. And the flipping upside is, yes, they had lots of good pit stop practice, but the reason they didn't retire Norris is because they wanted to collect more data, you know, how limited it is with testing. And they're coming away saying, well, one, we sort of fixed one of our problems because, Piastri mucked up his qualifying lap, but his race stint was within a sort of a tenth and a half average lap of Norris, which is, okay, there's a very, very small sample size to go from because it was only, you know, 13 races, but that was his best executed race stint across testing and in a Grand Prix, and is, you know, half the gap that Ricciardo had. And they were basically coming into this weekend expecting to be annihilated, to be the laughing stock of Formula One. And they reckon they underplayed it in qualifying a little bit, and their initial race pace suggests that they can fight for a point, which is not brilliant. That's not part of the recovery plan. It's not a success story, but it's not the absolute nightmare write off everything pre-upgrade in Baku that they thought it would be. Now, again, that could just be the like maelstrom of the midfield. It needs to settle and McLaren will get shuffled back in that. But they are genuinely, and I don't think it's like a put a positive spin on a disaster for the sake of a good press release, any of that. I think they're genuinely pleasantly surprised that it was they're not like they're not an embarrassment. I mean, Lando Norris was say was he was asked like, you know, you are the team leader now, whether you like it, both through age and performance, you're the team leader. It's up to you to pick up these like, fallen people at the back of the factory. And he said, that's not something I have to do. We are buoyed by what we have seen, which is a damning indictment of McLaren in 2023. Wow. But it's yeah, I sound like I'm getting an invoice from them in the post sometime soon. I'm not, but it's not. We're all beating on them. They're not beating on themselves. But maybe that's why they're not doing very good, because their pressure's not high enough. But the good news is that I think they're saying, Andrea Stella is saying that basically his office overlooks a new wind tunnel and he can hear the fans starting. And they reckon it could be influencing the car by June.
Well, if you look at, as Kev mentioned, last year being awful at Bahrain, I think if you look at kind of pace and just generally where they were, I mean, they finished, what, 14th and 15th last season. They were absolutely nowhere. That that Norris was fighting, you know, within the midfield at the start of the race. And he was, you know, he was already at that point suffering from the legacy of the pneumatic issues that was required him to make six pit stops. And the fact that, you know, degradation or no, he was still on the back of Sainz and Hamilton in their scrap. There's little reasons, there's little nuggets that kind of glimmer and shine and give them some degree of hope. And I think once they've had a chance to arrest some of those issues and, you know, bring their new package in for Baku or wherever it's going to be, I think they've said pretty openly that the concept they've started this year with isn't, you know, the direction they want to go in. They want to change that, probably, you know, as we mentioned earlier in the show, what Mercedes should be potentially looking at. You know, this gives them some trajectory, and I think this will probably be among the worst of their season. And things will definitely get better throughout the year. It just depends on when those updates will come online. It depends on, as you mentioned, if the wind tunnel will have any influence on the car or not. I think there are reasons to be relatively cheerful, and it's not all over. And I think, you know, by the end of the season, they'll probably finish maybe sixth or seventh in the championship. It won't be amazing, but, you know, it will be a much better return than what it looks like at the moment.
Well, there we go. That's our podcast for today. Thank you, chaps. That was good fun. JBL, when are you next in the paddock with your new role covering Formula One for us?
Saudi Arabia is my first race. So Alex Kalanorkas will be rotating, as him and Mr. Q did last year. Hopefully it goes okay.
It's you two in Saudi. You won't have heard yet, but the Alex Travel Diary, which is Saturday's podcast, he is broken by Bahrain traffic. So can we
I was out there for testing, and they're celebrating their independence, and it brought on some spirited driving. So if we're stuck at lights and are annoyed at traffic, we tend to maybe pip the horn, flash the lights. They just stand on the accelerator and let their V8s ping off the red line, which is like just insane. I suppose that, you know, they can afford to, because petrol is pretty cheap out there, but it was just absolute madness. So we're then having to weigh up in the hire car. Right, we've got the extra insurance to protect the underside, but we're just going to have to take it off road to get around all the madness. So full credit to Alex, and also the hotel, despite being like sort of fairly nicely appointed, nothing too salubrious. Don't worry, Autosport subscribers, that's not where your money's going. But it was obviously built in the 70s when cars were 1970s size. So I do have sympathy for Alex for that one. It was utter bedlam.
Kev, I think we have to send Alex some sort of care pack when he gets home, because he is disturbed by cars going around roundabouts the wrong way. He's like, I'm not driving in Bahrain again.
That does sound stressful. Although, to be honest, I mean, being driven around by Q is quite stressful as well. So I'm not quite sure which one he'd... he's a bit of a, you know, pedal to the metal kind of guy as well. So
I think we've got a few speeding tickets haven't arrived in the UK post yet from last year. I'm sure they're still arriving.
To put them on expensive.
I'm not going to engage in this conversation because I got YouTube commentator referring to me as the bad boy of Formula One. So it's nice to be compared to James Hunt, but... I won't engage myself with that.
Well, I hadn't
heard
that.
Bad Boy Formula One. Wow, that's. Yeah. I mean, that's quite a claim. There's a lot of candidates for that. I mean, I should do one of my top tens for that. Top ten bad boys of F1. Oh no, I'm not going to do that.
How's a bleep machine, Martin? I can give several examples of why current drivers might qualify for that title more than me.
Yeah, no, I think it's been good today. I think we've got away with today. Bleep machine not needed. Unlike on the world feed, when Alonso went in for a man hug on Stroll and realised that, he didn't realise that he had his microphone in his hand and dropped an F-bomb on the air, praising how good Stroll was. That's going to be an interesting dynamic to watch this year. But we should probably wrap this up. So there you go, that's your podcast for today. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to chip in, you can email us anytime. It is podcast@autosport.com is my email address. No, it's not my one, but I get access to it. And you can also find us on social media as well. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Sports Social Podcast Network.